Hello, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territory of the Hukkaminam-speaking Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. I'm Madeline Taylor. Since the summer of 2015, it has been impossible to avoid the story of the refugee crisis. Wars in the Middle East, notably in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Palestine, along with a number of other war-torn nations, have resulted in a staggering number of displaced people globally. This summer, the crisis dominated the international press. Tens of thousands of people began crossing the Aegean Sea in tiny boats hoping to reach the shores of Europe. Thousands died in the crossing, and the reality of the wars in the Middle East and Africa could no longer be ignored by Western media. The small island of Lesbos, off the coast of Greece, became the most popular destination for refugees attempting the crossing. As of October 25th, 562,000 people had arrived by sea in Greece, 93,000 of these on the shores of Lesbos. This influx of people completely overwhelmed the tiny island, which normally only houses around 86,000 people. The population doubled and resources were scarce. There were lots of calls for aid from organizations on the ground, and there's been a concerted effort to find a better way to help intake refugees. Last week, I had the chance to speak with John Skeen, a young Canadian man who flew to Greece to help. He was moved by the humanity of refugees he heard about on the news and knew he needed to do something. Here is our interview.
Hi, my name is John Skeen. I'm a 28-year-old Victorian man who just came back from Lesbos, Greece.
John, can you tell me a little bit about why you decided to go to Lesbos?
I booked my ticket the morning after I had read an article about a woman who arrived on Lesbos and begged a volunteer to kill her and her family after everything she had been through. And it was an article that really moved me, just seeing kind of the human suffering behind such a tragic event. And the next day I woke up and I went down to a flight center and I booked my ticket. The woman was fleeing the Syrian revolution happening in Syria right now, and as well, people on the same boat that were interviewed in that story were from areas such as Afghanistan and Iraq, which are also facing a lot of oppression from groups like the Taliban and ISIS in those fronts as well. This woman specifically had taken the six-mile trek from Turkey over on a rubber dinghy to Lesbos. So the interview with her was done when she arrived in Greece.
Now, what was your understanding of the refugee crisis in Europe before hearing this story?
Before, I think, you know, it was shrouded in so much, you know, misinformation. I think we're inundated with information now with social media and with the internet. However, the problem is that information isn't always correct. So beforehand, I kind of had a very generic understanding. I knew there was ISIS. I understood about that, and, you know, it was never my intention to go over there. I never had an idea that I would go, but after reading that article and then really digging and doing research that evening, I just found out how horrible it is for, you know, regular civilians over there right now.
What was it about that woman's story in particular, though, that humanized the situation to the point where you were compelled to get on a plane?
I think just seeing the picture of her and recognizing that it's just a normal human being with a family and a life. And I think media now, you know, especially with bigotry, tries to separate and tries to other that group of people because they aren't like us and, you know, they don't believe the same things. And although there are differences, I think there's a connecting, you know, human quality that we all want to live in peace. And I think somebody showing up to a foreign country by the most dangerous means necessary and begging to be killed really resonated because all she wanted was peace.
And she was expecting peace and death. So I'm wondering, what kind of expectations did you have of the experiences that you would have before arriving, and then what was the biggest change that you felt once you were there?
Yeah, I was I was anticipating that the camps would be somewhat chaotic, that the situation would be not necessarily out of control, but not comfortable. And I was quite surprised by the work of the NGO that I worked with, Starfish Foundation, the amazing work that they've been able to do to really make it as comfortable as possible for people. There's some scenes that I, you know, experienced on the beach that are a little more chaotic. You know, people coming off of a boat, and it's extremely dangerous. However, once they got into Oxy, which is the transit camp that I worked at, things were a lot calmer, and I think there's a real sense of just being grateful, and there was a real gentleness to people when they arrived there.
Can you take me through what you experienced when you first arrived in Greece, your intake process into Oxy?
Sure, yeah. Athens was a nightmare. It was so hard to find someone who spoke English. I couldn't even get somebody to show me where a bathroom was. They would shoo me out of their store. It's an incredibly economically depressed city. Nothing that I ever would have, you know, when you picture Athens, it's nothing that I had ever imagined. It's a 10.5-hour ferry ride to Mytilene, which is the port city in Lesbos. So that's an overnight trip. Immediately, you're greeted with a beautiful Greek island, and the second you get into port, there was tents and hundreds of people waiting to get on the boat to go to Athens. From there, I took a taxi about 45 minutes to the north side in Petra. That's where I stayed, just south of Molyvos. And from there, I had to do a volunteer intake meeting. We kind of got the rundown of the situation and what Starfish does specifically to help the situation. And the next day, I was, you know, on my shift in Oxy.
And how far away is the Oxy camp from the beaches where all of these refugees are arriving?
It's about a 10 or 15-minute bus ride, so it's not that long. The IRC and Starfish, some really great NGOs, have coordinated buses because in the summer people were having to walk. They'd have to walk to Mytilene from Molyvos, which would take around 3 days, depending on the heat.
So all of this organization and process around intake of refugees is very new then?
Yeah, it's something they kind of did in response to. You know, I was just reading a story today. Melinda McCroskey, who founded Starfish, you know, was originally saying that, you know, well, at first it was 100 people a week, and then when it became 1,000 people a day, they understood that things kind of needed to be done. And I think what she's done and what smaller NGOs have done have been able to use, they've been able to use media to go in there and garner attention, get international volunteers in to just do things. Whereas larger organizations who some people can be quite critical of, and I hold my own criticism, however, they have come in as well now. So it's really the work of small NGOs doing things quickly, whereas the larger ones, although they're there, I think a lot of their red tape and bureaucracy can kind of hamper their efforts.
Absolutely. And I read a number that you mentioned in your press release saying that there were 73,000 people who arrived on the beaches of Lesbos in September alone. So what does that look like from your perspective, helping people find their bearings on this Greek island in a refugee camp?
Yeah, it's a constant inflow and outflow. So we're loading buses to go south to the camps where they get papers, but there's also buses coming from Eftelou Beach, which is the beach. If they landed on that beach, they came to us in Oxy. So it was a constant inflow and outflow. The only time people would stay is if their families got separated. They would wait for them there, hoping that they would land on the same beach that they did, because if they didn't, they'd get separated. So it wasn't a very chaotic process. People obviously want to move on, but it was there was a real general sense of order and structure, and refugees very, very grateful for the help that we were providing.
Now, when you talk about families being separated by arriving on different beaches, are you saying that different families are separated into different boats before they leave wherever they're coming from to head to Greece?
Yeah, so the smugglers, to the best of our knowledge, are Turkish mafia. Turkey has some of the highest journalist incarceration rates in the world, so it's a little difficult to kind of get a sense of what's going on those beaches. On a clear day, they can actually, with good binoculars, you can see right over. It's not very far. To our knowledge, that was what was happening. So the smugglers would load a boat, and if, groups of family units around 20 to 25 weren't all that uncommon. So if by pure math a boat was full and there was a couple other family members left, they would just separate them, and they don't have a choice. They would shove a gun in their face.
I'm wondering if you can take me through sort of like the sights and smells that you would encounter on an everyday basis. Like, if you're dealing with people being brought in from beaches, they've been on the move for days and days and days, what kind of a state are people in medically and mentally?
Yeah, the medical state of refugees, you know, change frequently depending on a lot of things. If weather held them up in Turkey for a few days, you know, the initial arrival of those refugees would be a lot different than if it was a steady flow. On the Turkish side, they don't normally have access to food and water. So lots of states of dehydration, shock, hypothermia, broken ankles from getting out of the boat in rocks, and, you know, pure confusion. I had a lot of people come up to me with a map of Europe and just point at it and ask me where. So there was a general sense of confusion. Thankfully, Starfish and other local NGOs have really done a great job of, you know, providing signage in both Farsi and Arabic to try to communicate where to go. The UN does provide, little info tours for refugees just arriving into Oxy, so they'll give them, you know, very practical information.
What kind of impact did this have on your psyche? Like, when you would go back to wherever you were staying at night, was it a hotel?
Yeah, it was.
So what kind of thoughts are you having at the end of a day when you get home and you have some time to yourself to relax and go to sleep?
Yeah, that was the hardest part. I think being in the camp was generally a positive experience. You know, you were seeing people in a moment of chaos, and some of them, you know, had lost family members, and it was horrible. But seeing the kind of human resilience in that situation, in children and in families, was really great. But going home was hard, and just processing that. Thankfully, you know, just kind of socializing with other volunteers was very helpful. But especially after the Paris attacks, I was there during that, and that was very difficult to then go back and see what people were saying purely out of ignorance. So that was the hardest part to process, whereas in the camps, it was generally a very happy environment.
Well, I know personally when I've traveled, and I've never experienced anything anywhere close to what you're describing in terms of interacting with crisis, but even just travel in a regular way, it's sometimes difficult to communicate with people back home what you've actually experienced. So I'm wondering if you had any contact with family or friends here while you were away that was either made you feel separate from mentality back home or more connected?
I think, you know, I've always been quite close with my direct family and, you know, my close friends. So just being able to FaceTime, and, I use social media to try to humanize the situation, and I think in a large part to try to process it myself. So I was able to use technology to communicate. I focused a lot on human stories. There's a large political angle of this crisis, but in my opinion, I don't think, social media is the tool to be doing things most effectively. What I could do was to humanize the people that I met and that I spent my time with.
Yeah, can you walk me through a couple of the more standout interactions you had with people in the camps?
Sure, yeah. A man named Faisal was, that was an amazing man and just an amazing story. He had a large wound on his head, and I didn't see it at first. He was under a bunch of blankets in our food tent, so I just assumed he was a night shift volunteer. But when he woke up, I realized that he had a wound in his head and half of his whole left side was completely paralyzed. So we had to help him eat, go to the bathroom, get on the bus. And he was shot in the head after the Bashar al-Assad regime, which is the current government in Syria, found out that he was fighting in the Free Syrian Army against the government. When that happened, they took his family and him into their house. They shot his mother, his sister, and his father in the head in front of him, and then him last so he would see it. And they left him, and he survived. I don't know how he made it to Turkey. He could barely walk alone. We, you know, in helping him, a family came over and started hugging him, and we learned after that he had bought a life jacket for one of their family members and gave it to them, saying, you know, if I die in the ocean, then I die. I think he had gone through so much that, you know, at that point, he had nothing left. And they got separated in the boat loading process and then came together again in Oxy, and we saw that moment. And that family then kind of accepted him into their family unit. And when they went on to the other camp, we had a wheelchair waiting for him. And, yeah, strangers the day before and probably his only chance to survive that day. So, amazing story.
It's amazing how survival is a day-to-day process for all of these people arriving in Europe. And how, and how long were people, had people been on the move when you met with them?
It varied quite greatly. You know, I dealt with one family that had been on the road from Damascus for 3 years. Some people, it was a matter of weeks. It depends a lot on their mobility and their, you know, ability to access, you know, airplanes and things wherever they're from. It was quite common to see, you know, Afghan or Iraqis. The children's shoes, especially with worn-out soles, completely just gone, disintegrated. So they had been walking for weeks. And, you know, their journey forward through Europe can take anywhere from a week to a month as well, depending on, their access to transportation.
Can you share the story about Ghazi?
Yeah. Ghazi was a four-year-old boy. Him and his family have been on the move from Damascus for 3 years. We had Wi-Fi for a couple of days in camp, so I was sitting and playing blocks with him and his older brother. And I Google translated, how long have you been a refugee? And he said three. His brother, older brother said three. I had said 3 months, and his brother said no. And I went down from weeks and then days and then years. And he said, yes, years. So they've been on the run for almost Ghazi's entire life. Their family was separated by Turkish smugglers. Their grandmother, aunt, and little girl. And they waited there for 2 days. So watching that family kind of process, not knowing if their family was alive, not knowing where they were or if they had made it, was very difficult. And the moment that they got off the bus, the entire family, you know, started crying. And it was an amazingly human experience.
So they were reunited.
Yeah, it was a really nice, happy ending. They didn't happen that often in our perception because people moved from our camp so quickly. So they got reunited, and, you know, I said goodbye to them, which was hard, but I got all of their Facebook information and emails, and we sent video messages, and I'm hoping to go visit them in Germany on my way back next year.
What do you most wish that people at home understood about the situation that you see as a gap?
You know, I think that these people are, again, just normal human beings. We have this idea that there's a real divisive quality in North America, and I think we're seeing that a lot in the American election. We saw that, you know, vehemently in our own election. It was disgusting to see that in our own country. But that, you know, history repeats itself, and we need to be extremely careful. In 1939, the SS St. Louis was a boat that took off from Europe carrying Jewish refugees. And when it tried to dock in Cuba, America, and Canada, nobody would take them. And they got sent back, and a lot of them were killed. So we really need to be careful when we're saying, you know, divisive things about these people, because history repeats itself, and we need to be mindful that our actions in the past have killed people, and we need to be very careful and understand that political pressure is a big thing. When Aylin Kurdi's body washed up on the shore, there was a lot of political pressure to then do something. And rightfully so, after Paris attack, there was a lot of political pressure to do something, misguided, but there was a lot of pressure. And just seeing it kind of change from a fearful reaction to a positive reaction in Canada, and now to see all the Syrian refugees coming, has been a really nice thing.
Yeah, well, I'm wondering what you think of the Canadian government's policies on refugee intake, especially, I think what I've noticed is that the Syrian, especially the Syrian refugee crisis, but generally the refugee crisis in Europe, is often mentioned in the same breath as the Paris attacks. And from my point of view, they're very separate events. So can you speak to that?
Yeah, I'm very proud of my country. I think 25,000 is, you know, it's not a lot, you know, on Lesbos alone, they have 3,000 to 5,000 people arriving a day, you know, in the summer. So there's a lot of need. Germany today, I just saw, officially hit 1 million registered. But the Paris attacks and the crisis are totally different. You know, acts done by a small group of insane people, that's not reflective of a community of 11 million people.
And the insane people you're referring to are those who attacked Paris on November 13th.
Yes, ISIS and other extremist groups.
Can you talk about your decision to go back in March?
Sure. I think just for my mental health, having this opportunity to really speak to media, I'm doing local fundraisers in January and February. I'm partnering with local, you know, community organizations. It's been a great opportunity to really shed light on this issue. But I think for me personally and how I've had to process this when I'm alone, knowing that I can go back and that's a reality, has really helped. My favorite thing to do is to help them directly. However, when I'm home, I know I can use other tools. So it was extremely hard leaving, and I'm really looking forward to going back.
Do you plan to interact with any refugee intake organizations here in the Lower Mainland?
Yeah, I'm partnering with the Victoria Immigration and Refugee Center Society. So I had a great meeting with them, really receptive, amazing group of people doing really cool things. They provide resources for new immigrants and refugees. And I'm really excited to help them fundraise and help them raise awareness about their work, and also to raise awareness on my work. I also have a GoFundMe set up that I used for my first trip. I haven't closed it, and I'm just going to continue on for my next trip. It's gofundme.com/johnskenelesvos. That's John Skeen Lesvos.
Fantastic. Is there anything you want to add before we sign off here?
I think just around awareness on Bashar al-Assad and recognizing that, you know, he's used chemical sarin gas against his people. He's starved rebels in prison. He's killed upwards to 300,000 people based on extremely conservative estimations. And I think we really need to be switching our focus. ISIS is a group of really ignorant, angry young men, whereas Bashar al-Assad has a lot of governments backing him. And from all of the refugees I've spoken to, in Syria still and outside, the real enemy is this man.
What do you think the Canadian government should do in response to this level of violence, given the backing that Bashar al-Assad has from other nations around the world?
I think we need to hold them more to account of who they're associating with. You know, I know Canada doesn't have a necessary, you know, a militaristic reputation, but I think there's a lot of things that we could be doing as a community to really be holding these people to account. You know, war crimes and crimes against humanity have happened throughout history, and, you know, through appeasement and just kind of willful ignorance, they continue on. You know, these crimes are happening every day. These people are getting bombed every day, and it's, you know, because we're not getting angry enough, we're not saying enough. We all have a voice and a way to put pressure on people to do things, and it would be great if we kind of used it more. My hope is that when we start getting Syrian families here, that they start talking to Canadians and they start telling us what they experienced in their home. You know, there's a lot of things going on in the world between climate change and economic depression, and we're quickly learning that globalization did not work, and these kind of divisive borders and the thought of othering, again, other people. We really need to realize that everything that happens here is affecting each one of us. And if we were true globalists, we wouldn't be discriminating against people, regardless of where they lived.
John, thank you so much for your thoughts and for sharing your experiences.
In a mine,
where a million diamonds shine.
We dig, 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 dig from early on to night.
This is Lauren Calder reporting from the Climate and Environment Desk here at News 101. I am here today with Ugo Lapointe of Mining Watch Canada, and he is in British Columbia today to tell us all about what we should know about mining here in BC. Hi, Ugo. What are you doing here today?
So it is part of my mandate to tackle mining issues all across Canada. Canada is a powerhouse for mining internationally, but we do also a lot of mining domestically. And the three main mining jurisdictions in Canada right now are Quebec, Ontario, and BC. Mm-hmm. And so I intend to spend quite a bit of time in BC during this mandate that I just started with Mining Watch this year. I'm hoping to come here maybe two or three times a year, spend a few weeks connecting with communities that are affected by mining, First Nations communities, but also non-First Nation communities, connecting with policymakers, lawmakers, and different civil society groups, environmental groups, in the hope to effect positive changes in the way mining is being regulated and mining is being conducted environmentally, socially, and in terms of human rights and First Nation rights perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of us here in the city, we don't necessarily, we're not so much involved with mining. But BC, as you said, is a pretty big player. Can you give us some idea of what kind of mining operations are in BC?
The important thing to keep in mind is that try to have a perspective on the global trends of mining and where do we fit as citizens that consumes metals. What we're seeing over the last 10 to 20 years is that there's more and more mines on the planet digging for metals. The mines are becoming bigger and bigger, but the grades, the quality of the metal in the rock is actually diminishing. There's less and less metals. Often it's the average is way below 1% of the rock that you extract is actually metals. So 99% is actually waste that you need to store on the land forever. And you need to make sure that that waste doesn't spill anywhere. So we're on a trend where the environmental impacts related to water consumptions, to energy consumption, to footprint of those mines is getting bigger and bigger when there are communities around that are affected more. And you also see increasing human rights issues as well across the planet. So I think we're at a stage that, a bit like the climate justice, like energy issues have done over the last 10, 15 years, we need to start thinking about the mineral mining metals impacts and how we can affect positive change. And one of those areas is probably we need to start thinking of reducing some of those metal consumption in our lives. And, you know, it's going to be different depending on the metal. You talk about, you know, gold is certainly a big industry, probably 30 to 40% of all mines on the planet are gold mines. But what is gold, you know, used for? Or primarily jewelry. So maybe we need to think about that. Whereas iron is, and copper and nickel is different. That's primarily used for urbanization, city building, industrialization, some electronics, which have a different purpose for societal needs. And So with this in mind, you know, Canada then, and BC in particular, need to think about improving its overall footprint from mining.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be tackled from different angles. And one of the some of the angles that we work on is policy and regulatory reforms for better protections of people that are around mines, better protection of the environment, community support. So those that are affected by mining can get a proper support, technical support, or strategic support when facing choices of mine near their communities. And then the other angle is corporate accountability. So it means like targeting companies, shareholders, companies' boards to try to make them accountable for their choices and the way they operate mines.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we think of mining regulation here in BC, most people tend to think of the Mount Polley disaster, which happened in 2014, August, right?
Right.
Can you give us a bit of background of that disaster and the ongoing issues around that?
Yeah, I mean, like the Mount Polley disaster was the biggest mining spill in the history of Canadian mining, and probably one of the biggest environmental spill in the whole history of Canada. We're talking about nearly 20-25 billion liters of liquid and solid waste that was spilled and destroyed the Hazelton Creek over almost 10 kilometers long, and then spilled into Quesnel Lake in the Quesnel watershed downstream, which eventually reached the Fraser River. The immediate impacts were water bans for a few days or weeks, and then, of course, instant killings of all the animals that were in the way of that massive spill. But the long-term impacts are still unknown. There's a lot of contaminants that went into the watershed that may affect future salmon fishery and so on. There's also impacts that were on the local businesses, whether they be, you know, recreational, touristic, fishing, hunting businesses that were in the area, and of course the impacts on the First Nations people that use the land or have a deep spiritual connection with that land were very affected by that spill. Now, a year later, where we're at, well, in terms of the reaction from the government did recognize there was a problem. They did commission a technical report that was published in January, which assessed what happened. And they also suggested, that report also suggested, to change a lot of the regulations and the way mining tailings are being operated. So there is currently an ongoing review of the what we call the mining code to see what we can change in terms of tailings management. Mm-hmm. We're still a bit concerned about the direction that it's taking. There's some positive step being done by the BC government, but probably not enough. So that's why a lot of our work in 2016 will try to focus to push the government for greater changes and with these massive wet tailings pond, which we should try to avoid at all cost with, and going with alternatives which are less risky. And just recently, like 2 weeks ago, there was another major spill in Brazil, Samarco, another mine. But again, that reminds us that this issue is not only a BC issue, it's a global mining industry issue. And while BC is reviewing its regulations now, we also need to push internationally and in other countries to do the same, so that overall the global industry, mining industry, is doing a better job at protecting the environment and the communities around.
Because a lot of mines are based in Canada that operate internationally. So,
in fact, 60 to 70% of all mining companies across the planet are registered in Canada in one of the stock exchanges, whether it's in Toronto or Vancouver. Mm-hmm. It's become a specialty of Canadian business. So that means, in our opinion, that we have then a higher responsibility as Canadians to make sure that this industry is not destructive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you notice any differences between how BC regulates its mining compared to other Canadian provinces?
Absolutely. And, you know, I wouldn't say that there's one province that is perfect. I think there is positive or more progressive or higher performance criteria in some other provinces. So, for example, Quebec just changed its mining laws over the last 2-3 years. They now require greater financial assurance prior to mining. That means that there is money set aside for in case the mining company goes bankrupt, and then we need to clean up that site, because there's always a site to clean up after. You know, BC is not quite that same level of financial assurance. So that's a problem, because you and I and taxpayers in BC are on the hook. You know, if Montpoly Imperial Metals go bankrupt tomorrow, we inherit the bill to clean up everything. There is also improvement that we're done in Quebec regarding community choices. So now municipalities will be able to designate no-go zones for mining in their territory. So zones that are too sensitive ecologically or economically or socially will be out of bound for mining. And that is a major issue in all across Canada. Letting community do proper land use management and designate areas where mining could go and others that it should not go. And BC does not allow that, actually. So most of the BC land, over 80%, is open to mining, and the communities have practically no legal means to say no to mining.
Wow. Okay, well, thank you so much for your insights. Any last thoughts? I know you're trying to, again, there has been trends, as you mentioned, towards this kind of self-regulation. You're trying to rebalance that through the work of Mining Watch.
Yeah, that's right. The self-regulation is an issue where over the last decade we let the industry control its own operation, control its own pollution monitoring, and so on. And so, and that is out of balance. We need to come back to a more more oversight from the government and the ministries. And that was part of the lessons from the Mont Poly disaster too. But that's also clashing with the trend that we've seen across governments in Canada, where governments want to cut and cut in their budget year after year, reduces expenses. But that logic has its limitation when you don't have any more expertise in the ministries to do the job they're supposed to do, that is protect the public interest, protect the environment, and protect the communities that are...
As a station, we believe in playing content with artistic and cultural merit, and sometimes that category includes material which can be construed as offensive. For those who have children nearby or are sensitive to provocative material, the following broadcast may have strong language, themes, or be otherwise objectionable. Please consider tuning out and revisiting CITR after this program.